Добро пожаловать в Трансформаторную, подкаст о личностных и организационных изменениях. С вами Сергей Макаркин, agile-коуч, психолог и философ-любитель. В каждом эпизоде я делюсь идеями и инструментами, которые могут быть полезны в личностной и организационной трансформации.
So, hello, my friends. It's Sergey Makarkin here, and I want to introduce today a very special guest that I'm really glad to have here on my podcast. So it's Tony Romandier, and he is a clinical faculty of University of Washington, and also he's a psychologist in Seattle who focuses on deliberate practice for psychotherapists. Welcome, Tony. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Sergey. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So for those of my listeners who are not familiar with what you're doing, the reason why I'm so excited having you here is because you are one of the leading scientists working on this idea of deliberate practice applied to psychotherapist training. And when I learned about it, I was so fascinated because I think it very nicely applies to the Scrum Master and facilitation stuff, the things that I'm working in, and probably most of my listeners are interested in this. So could you please tell us a little bit about how you got into psychology and specifically how you got interested in this deliberate practice idea and started applying it?
Yeah, so I became a psychologist because I enjoy helping people, and I felt like I might be pretty good at helping people. And at first in my training, I thought it was going really well. I thought I was helping people. But as my training went on and on, I started to get this feeling that maybe I wasn't helping everyone. And then as time went on and I started collecting outcome data from my clients, I realized to my shock that actually there are quite a few clients that I was not helping, like sometimes half. And some of my clients were actually deteriorating, meaning they're getting worse during therapy. Now, at first, I was very embarrassed about this and I didn't want to tell anyone. But as I read the research from across the field of psychotherapy from around the world, I found that this is actually, this is common for therapists to not be able to help all their clients, even though we help many of our clients. And I started wondering, how can I get to become a better therapist? And that at first I tried the traditional methods of psychotherapy training. So I read a lot of books. I went to a lot of workshops. I wrote, a lot of papers. I got a lot of supervision, but I found those methods were kind of limited in helping me with certain clients. And that's how I found deliberate practice.
Okay, so I've done some homework and looked at the literature about this topic. And what I found was really counterintuitive things, that most of the stuff that usually thought as a way of becoming better therapist, like having a supervisor or this continuous education program, and also being relying on experience itself, seems that some of them aren't working as good as we thought. And one of the really fascinating finding that I was able to find in the literature is that experience actually sometimes have an opposite relation to the client outcomes. So the more experienced a therapist is, the worse his or her client outcomes. So is it really such a difficult problem for a psychotherapist to kind of get necessary skills to help people?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's just psychotherapy. It's pretty much anything. I mean, if you learn, football, if you learn how to play the violin, if you learn how to fly a plane, doing it for many years, it helps you remember how to do it, but it doesn't automatically make you better and better and better at it. Like, what makes you what makes people better at a skill typically is observing their performance, getting feedback on the performance, and then rehearsing or practicing to improve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, it turns out that might be true for psychotherapy as well.
Okay. And so what I've, I think there was a book named like Code of Talent or something. I don't remember the last name of the author. And he was writing about the way how the top talent musicians or sportsmen are training. And it seems like this is an idea that kind of at the core of the deliberate practice as a like, approach. So could you explain a little bit more what deliberate practice is?
Yeah, it's a term coined by Kay Anders Erickson, who's a psychologist in the science of expertise. So they study how do professionals achieve competence and then expertise and then maintain it across their career. And they were looking for what are the vital ingredients, the necessary ingredients for expertise. And through a series of studies, they came create this term called deliberate practice. So what is deliberate practice? Deliberate practice is roughly composed of observing work performance. So for a therapist, that would be observing a videotape of a session, ideally, but maybe an audio, listening to an audio tape, getting feedback from an expert coach or a supervisor, right, about how to improve. Setting specific skill goals that are just beyond our ability, right? This is tricky in psychotherapy because there's so many things we're doing in psychotherapy, right? And we just need to learn something that's just beyond our ability, right? Like if I was learning to play basketball and I had one of the top basketball players coaching me, that might not help because he would be showing me to do things that are way beyond my ability, you know? Yeah. So you need a coach who can show you just beyond your ability. And then four, and this is important. This is something we haven't done in psychotherapy before, rehearsing those skills many mm-hmm. times, right? So can I ask you, do you play any musical instruments or play any sports?
So when I was a little boy, I was playing the harmonica, like the big one.
Harmonica.
Yeah, but I do some couple dancing, so you can consider it sort of sports. Some extent, you have to learn some skills which are complex by doing the same stuff over and over again.
And you get coaching and those skills? Yeah, yeah, okay, great. So let's say you learned a new dance
mm-hmm.
and you wanted to perform in front of a live audience. How many times would you want to rehearse before you perform?
So it depends on the complexity of the dance and also
let's say very complex
of the level of my current skills. And
yeah.
I would probably have a lot of rehearsal and closer to the like this the yeah. show date, I would try yeah. to make it as close to live experience as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, great. So, and that's true for many sports. It's true for, you know, typically musicians, if you ask a musician, how many mm-hmm. times do you want to rehearse a musical piece before performing for an audience? They'll say, I mean, hundreds sometimes, you know, so, you know what I mean? Psychotherapists have never done that.
Yeah.
We don't rehearse, even though what we're doing is a performance art. We're performing with a live audience. And not only that, it's what we're doing, I don't think is any easier than dancing. I don't think it's any easier than music.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's just as complex.
So here is the thing. When I read this book, The God of Talent, like a couple of years ago, probably.
Yeah.
I was really excited about the idea of like splitting the complex skill into some small yeah. parts and yeah. then rehearsing them over and over again.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, that might be a really great way to train the scrum masters or agile coaches or facilitators to do their job. But yeah. the problem for me was that I couldn't get like, I couldn't grasp how do I actually split this complex work of, like, for example, working with a group of people and leading them, like creating the container so that they could reach right. their goal.
Right.
And what I found at your website, it's dpfortherapist.com for those who would like to learn more about that, is that it was so cool how could you extract these, like, small but repeatable pieces and create them into the exercise. So I wonder how you've done this specific part, because I think this is the most important and the harder thing was to do, at least from my perspective.
Well, thank you very much. And I agree, it's definitely the hardest thing. There's a number of us trying to figure out how to do this for psychotherapy. And the short answer is we don't know yet. Like, we're just beginning to experiment with this. And I want to be very honest. It could take us 10, 20 years to figure out how to practice psychotherapy, right? I mean, it took people hundreds of years to figure out how to practice classical music. Mm-hmm. You know, it took people many years to figure out how to practice sports. And what we're doing is, you could argue, is way more complex than music or sports, because we're improvising every time and every performance is unique and different based on the therapist and the client, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what we've been doing is looking for what are what we call the common factor skills across psychotherapy. So what are the most basic skills that therapists will need to use with almost every client, regardless of what they're helping them with, whether it's anxiety, depression, life goals, whatever it is. And I, for a little while, was focusing on the skills that are internal to the therapist. Mm-hmm. So my most recent book is on that. We call them the inner skills of psychotherapy. So helping the psychotherapist be self-aware of their feelings, of their thoughts, of their body sensations, so they can stay grounded while they're helping someone. Mm-hmm. We've got a series of books coming out that include basic skills from cognitive behavioral therapy. So that would be identifying maladaptive thoughts. Skills from emotion focus therapy, so that would be like empathy. And we've tried to break these skills down into as small chunks as possible, so therapists can rehearse them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So could you please tell a little bit more, like in more details, how this exercise could look like if I yeah. was, for example, to go to your website and try to do some of the videos that you have there?
Yeah, so for example, we have a skill on repairing ruptures. So rupture is in psychotherapy when there's a disagreement between the client and the therapist. Mm-hmm. And this happens often, and it's not a bad thing, assuming you can repair the rupture. But if you can't repair, then it is a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that happens in every model of therapy, with every therapist, with every client. Like it's a very broad general challenge or skill, and it tends to be a skill that beginning therapists are often frightened of, you know.
I've had some experience, and like that's the most challenging part of all.
Yeah,
it's especially when you feel that the client is
right.
really disagreeing with you. It's so right. creates so much like load, and you have to repair yeah. it, but what to do. So
what to do, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is every time is different, you know. With your dancing, you have the advantage of knowing what it's going to look like, or you know, knowing the moves. With psychotherapy, you don't know exactly what's going to happen every session. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can't try to just repeat the same session again and again and again. That's not going to help, right? Yeah. In fact, I did that when I was learning. I tried memorizing lines from famous psychotherapy books to say to my clients, and it did not go well at all. My clients,
I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Did not like that at all. So I learned you really have to improvise. And so what we do is we had an actor. We created a video of an actor playing a client who is frustrated or angry at the therapist. Mm-hmm. the client doesn't think therapy is helping very much. Mm-hmm. And the actor playing the client talks to the camera for about a minute or so, explaining why he doesn't think therapy is helping. And then we have a few what we call skill criteria, which are ways that the trainee or therapist should try to respond to the client. And when the video is done, the viewer can practice responding to the video. Mm-hmm. And they can say whatever they want.
And so it's just simple as that?
That's part of it.
Rules, okay.
That's part of it. Now, ideally, the therapist would record their answer and show that to a coach, mm-hmm. right? Or have a coach sitting next to them. And the coach would provide feedback. The coach might say like, oh, you didn't show, try to show more empathy, or try to talk a little slower, or try to maybe, you know, sit up more or smile more or any of these things, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. That's one of the pieces of feedback I got from a client once, was that I should smile more. I was like, oh, wow. sometimes it's very basic, but it takes rehearsing. And so after getting the feedback, the therapist can then rehearse again and mm-hmm. rehearse again and rehearse again. And we typically suggest trying for about 15 to 20 minutes, which will feel like a long time. You know, it'll feel a little tiring. It could feel a little boring. You know what I mean? Like it's not fun.
Yeah.
Rehearsal is not fun.
Yeah, I know. times,
yeah. But what the rehearsal does is it lets the therapist try out different responses, really experiment. It lets them find things that feel right to them. It lets them find things that feel wrong. And it moves the skills into what we call procedural memory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is where it's not just an idea, but it's actually almost in your muscles or bones.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. That's very
important. So when the therapist has to perform, they're better able to do it even if they feel anxious.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And is it possible to practice these skills just with a coach or the supervisor, or you can do it on your own, like when you have some time to sharpen some of your skills?
Yeah, so you can definitely do it on your own. However, the benefits are limited on your own. I mean, mm-hmm. they're good, but they're limited, because the advantage of having a coach is they can point out what we call your blind spots, the mistakes you're making that you're not aware of. Yeah. And so typically what we recommend is you get some coaching and the coach can provide some advice, and then you rehearse a bunch on your own based on that advice, mm-hmm. and then go back to the coach. And that's how people learn, you know, if you're going to learn chess or music or sports or fly a plane or anything else, that's the model typically is like 1 hour of coaching and a few hours of rehearsal.
Yeah. It's like when I remember when I was a child, I was learning to play this harmonica. You have like a lesson maybe two or three times a week.
Yeah.
Then you have some homework and you have to practice like an hour or maybe half an hour each day. And that makes the progress.
Well, yeah.
So that's a really cool thing. And as far as I know, you are also preparing these coaches. So you have some kind of certification program to become the deliberate practice coach. Could you speak a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So, I've been going around the world, or at least I was before the quarantines, to teach deliberate practice. And this is something we found a lot of therapists have been asking for, is a structured way to learn how to use deliberate practice as a therapist and then learn how to do coaching.
Yeah.
And so we've created, with Alexandre Vaz, a colleague of mine in Lisbon, Portugal, we've been working on a structured way to teach people how to use deliberate practice and then coach. And it'll take maybe 6 to 12 months mm-hmm. Of coaching. And then you have to show a video showing that, you know, you really know how to do it. And we've created a society of deliberate practice coaches to support this. So it's not really about us. It's kind of bigger than us, including psychologists in Scandinavia, Australia. And we're just starting this now, and we've got our first wave of coaches that we're training.
Okay, that's really cool. So the question that I have, I was really inspired by your work, and I used the videos that you have on your website to kind of sharpen some of my skills, which are like quite poor, I should admit.
Welcome to the club.
The thing is that I find that there's a lot of similarities between the skills that are required for psychotherapy and skills that are required for example, working with a group like facilitation, for example. And of course, there are quite a lot of differences, especially when it comes to the like theoretical models and like this kind of stuff. But then you also need to have like to have a rapport or like some kind of alliance with the people with whom you are working. You have to work with some objections and do it in a way that would not kind of feel people embarrassed or make them angry, but actually admit that their viewpoint is valid, but also provide maybe some ideas and invite them to collaborate on what to do. And so I thought that I might try to use the same approach to help some of the Scrum Masters whom I help in. And it seems like, well, first, it seems like it worked and is supposed to work. And there's from some anecdotal reports that I have, there's a subjective feeling that it actually helps. At least this stuff becomes more habitual. And as you said, it's a kind of muscle memory. But the question is, how do I know that this is actually working? Because I know that's really hard for therapy, and I wonder if there might be some insights on how to kind of accept these practices and apply them to this field of facilitation or Scrum Master.
Well, first of all, I think it's great that you're taking the deliberate practice and trying to apply it to your field. That was my goal with these books, is that people like yourself would take them and experiment and kind of make it your own. And because it's so new, what we really need is lots of people experimenting with different methods. So I was so happy when you contacted me and to see what you're doing. So I really encourage you to continue doing that, continue experimenting. So to your question about how to measure the results, unfortunately, in our field, that is hard. You know, when dancing, it's a little easier because people can just see, are you dancing well, you know? Or in sports, it's a little easier, right?
you can see, are you winning games? Timer and then,
Yeah, exactly, right? Or piloting, it's easier. Pretty much everything is easier. Because psychotherapy is so new. And I likewise, with your field, though I don't know it very well, I'm guessing it's a little kind of amorphous about, like, you know, measuring the actual results. Like, you can have people tell you that they feel better, that they feel more confident, and that's good. But ideally, we would want some kind of scientific measurement of that. And we don't really have that yet. We have outcome measures in psychotherapy, but they're not perfect. They're, you know, it's still early days in measurement, and it's hard to use rigorous science to measure the effects. So this is something that's going to take more years to do. Now, I'm okay with that. I think that's okay. You know, and we should still keep trying, but we should be humble. In terms, and not say like, oh, this is magic. This is going to make everyone better. This is going to solve all the problems. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So another thing that I would like you to speak a little bit about is this. So if I go to your website and open one of these exercises, I would also find the manual, which has a description of the skill.
Yeah.
Some of the like criteria that you have the skill. So I wonder, how do you formalize this criteria?
Well, so we built, that's a great question. We built the criteria from research on those skills.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the skills we focus on are what are considered the common factors in therapy. So these are variables in therapy that have been pretty well studied.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So John Norcross has a series of books on the Working Alliance and components of the Working Alliance. And so we're kind of building from there, and we're trying to stay grounded in the research as much as possible.
Okay.
That said, at some point, what we really need to do is research on the exercises to make sure that we're translating it well, so to speak. Not translating in terms of language, but translating, you know, from the original research to the deliberate practice exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I would add to that, because it's such early days, probably the most important thing we've done to develop the skill criteria is we've tested the exercises.
Mm-hmm.
So we will send the exercises to training programs around the world, and we'll say, try it and let us know what happens.
Okay.
And we'll hear like, oh, this worked or this didn't work. And part of the challenge here is, you know, every country has a different culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so something that works in America might not work in Russia, or might not work in Japan or Scandinavia. Yeah, So this is why I'm really excited that people like yourself are taking the exercises and translating them into, you know, your culture, your language, what your specific purpose, which is going to be different than what, you know, I need.
And as we mentioned, the translation part.
Yeah.
So do you have any plans of translating these exercises into other languages than English, maybe Russian or Japanese, as you mentioned it?
Yeah. So there's currently, there's a Swedish translation of one of my books. There's a Chinese translation of one of the books. We're about to do another. I would love to have a Russian translation if you know a publisher that's interested.
Okay. I think I would have a conversation with some people who I know. And what about the exercises? I mean, the speed of cues.
Right, the exercises on the website. Yeah. So those are easier to translate than a whole book. So if you or someone else wants to provide a Russian translation, well, first of all, you're welcome to translate yourself, but we'd also host them on our website. So what we're doing when we create these exercises, we're using what's called an open source model of development.
Mm-hmm.
Which means we create it, but then we just give it to the world, and people can do whatever they want with it. Okay. So we're not charging money. We're not defending, you know, trying to control them. It's kind of like open source software that is just created and released for people to use however they want. And we're hoping more and more psychologists use this model of development.
Yeah, this is very generous on your side to make it publicly available, but I believe that's a very important from the terms of public good.
I mean, thank you. I mean, sure, it might look generous, but really it's greedy, because my goal is that other people will do this as well, and so I will have access to more resources. So
that's a smart thinking, right?
Yeah. So hopefully that works.
Another question that I would like to ask is, you mentioned that there's a difference between intrapersonal and interpersonal and intrapersonal skills. So could you explain a little bit more on what are the differences of this in terms of using deliberate practice exercises?
Yeah. So, you know, most fields, whether you're learning to fly a plane or dance or whatever, there's kind of two components of a skill. There's the external component. So for dancing, it's like, how do you move your body? What are the moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an internal component, which is, can you, you know, manage your breathing? Do you have good enough fitness to be able to have enough energy? Have you stretched enough so your body doesn't get injured? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same for psychotherapy, where we have the external skills, which are, what do we say to the client? And then the inner skills, which is, can we stay calm? Can we stay self-aware? Can we stay in touch with our own thoughts and feelings that arise as part of psychotherapy, which sometimes are uncomfortable. And what we try to encourage therapists to do is practice both.
Yeah, I see why you're encouraged to do that. And it seems like the intrapersonal skills are sort of mindfulness training, but in a very applied sense.
That Bingo.
You're not just sitting in silence, but right. you actually learn to use it in a therapeutic situation.
Yeah, exactly. They are basically mindfulness skills. We have not invented mindfulness. You know, Buddhists have been doing mindfulness for thousands of years in other religious traditions. What we're doing is applying it very specifically, like you said, to the psychotherapy context. Because being mindful on your own in a room is very different than being mindful with a client who's very angry.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I also think that, again, here's a similarity between, for example, facilitation as a part of Scrum Master role and the psychotherapy, because the idea of behind facilitation is that the facilitator creates the container and he or she is supposed to stay neutral to the content, so not to influence on the way how the people's thoughts are flowing. And unless you are able to be mindful of your emotions and your thoughts in the process, not just when you're sitting on the pillow, but being there in the room where people have some heated discussions or they come up with the idea that you don't like, but it's their idea and maybe it's good to have them explore it. And it's really hard. So I find it really valuable idea. And I think it can also enrich the Scrum Master world. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe the final question, because we are kind of limited in time for this discussion, and maybe we could have another meeting like in a while.
Oh, that'd be great.
So how do you see the future of deliberate practice? Well, I know that it's a fair new field, so it's hard to predict stuff.
Right.
But maybe some of your ideas or where it could move.
Well, I can tell you what I hope will happen. What I hope will happen is, like what you're doing, professionals around the world will take these ideas and apply them to their particular needs, their particular culture, and experiment with creating exercises, with using the exercises, with coaching, and see what works. And we'll go through a period of, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of experimenting. And then also researchers will do serious empirical research trying to measure the effects. Because sometimes we feel like things are helping, but they're not really helping.
Yeah.
You know, like most therapists feel like they're getting better every year, even when they're not necessarily getting better.
Well, so, they're getting better in being confident and getting better.
Yes, that is improving. The very important point. So there was a recent study that examined using deliberate practice for learning motivational interviewing, you know, which is a very widely spread method of therapy. And they had a group of trainees who did traditional motivational interviewing and then a bunch that did deliberate practice. And they measured their skills 4 months after the training. And they found that both groups felt like they were getting a lot better. Only the group that did deliberate practice was actually getting better.
Okay, that's good news. At least there's a way to get better, right? Not just be more confident.
Yeah, there is. But we really need to study it. So what we need is, on one hand, people experimenting informally, and then also research. And I think if we can do that over decades, we can gradually figure out how to improve our field. And my dream is that our grandkids, if they become therapists, will be more effective than we could ever be. You know?
That's a great dream, I would say.
That's what's happened in other fields. You know, modern athletes perform way better than athletes 100 years ago.
Modern athletes could imagine 100 years ago.
They couldn't even imagine. Modern pilots are way, you know, better than even just a few decades ago. Modern, you know, musicians. I mean, and it's not because people are better. It's because the training has gotten better and better and better. Right? And so my hope, my dream is that, you know, today's top performing therapists in the future will be like the minimum, will be the baseline. So hopefully we'll see that happen.
Okay. I really hope that this will happen too. And thank you very much, Tony, for being here. Again, for those of my listeners who are interested in learning more about deliberate practice and applying it in there to become a better psychotherapist, I strongly recommend to visit your website, dpfortherapist.com, and also to read your book. I hope this will be eventually translated into Russian, and also some self-advertising. I'm going to publish the videos that you saw that are aimed to help Scrum Masters and facilitators to learn their skills at the dpforscrum.com. And so I wish you all the best, and hopefully we could meet again and discuss some further advancements in applying deliberate practice to improving people's lives and getting better skills for that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sergey. It's been really wonderful talking with you. So
bye-bye.
Thank you for the invitation.
Надеюсь, вам понравился этот эпизод. Если вы хотите поделиться идеей, выразить свое мнение или задать вопрос, пишите на info@sergeymakarkin.ru. Вы можете также написать мне в Фейсбуке или в Твиттере. Я буду признателен, если вы оставите отзыв об этом подкасте на iTunes или Google Podcast. Пока-пока!